Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavatam Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaita Mritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashajayinim Ambatvam Anusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. Let's start again on verse 14. Okay, I want to redo starting with 14 because so that I could introduce more of this section on tapas. Okay, so Devadvijak Guru Pradnya. Devadvijak Guru Pradnya Pujanam Shauchamarjavam Pujanam Shauchamarjavam Brahmacharyam Ahimsacha Brahmacharyam Ahimsacha Shariram Tapa Uchate Shariram Tapa Uchate Deva Dvija Guru Pradnya Pujanam Shaucham Arjavam Brahmacharyam Ahimsa Cha Shariram Tapa Uchate. In this section, Bhagavan is introducing tapas, and he is introducing tapas, a threefold tapas. The threefold tapas goes initially like this. The tapas itself, we can look at sattvika, tapas that is sattva. Tapas means austerities, religious disciplines that are sattvic in nature, that are rajas in nature, and that are tamas in nature. Okay? So that's the basic threefold. But when we're now going to look at the tapas which is sattva born. Which is sattvic, okay? There, it is viewed in three ways, different ways. The first one are austerities or religious disciplines. I'm just going to call it tapas, which is in relationship to the physical body. So it's called shariram tapas, tapas related to the physical body. The second one is tapas, which is vachika, related to the speech. The third one is tapas related to the mind. So these are the three forms of sattvika tapas, okay? Tapas born of sattva, religious discipline born of sattva. These type of sattvic, the sattvic tapas, has really for its goal antakarna shuddhi, purity of the mind. This is its purpose, as we'll see, is purity of mind and moksha. So purity of mind and moksha, not things that are to be achieved within samsara. Like, I'm doing this tapas so that I can get to Swargaloka, or I'm doing this tapas so I can get a better next birth, or I'm doing this tapas in order to gain any particular type of gain, so that I may become more dharmic. Then dharma becomes the reason, but the reason should be antakarana shuddhi. Dharma, if I want to gain more dharma or more punya so that I can gain something within samsara, a result within samsara. So a gain, an external gain, say like that. Whereas sattvika tapas, the only real reason is antakarana shuddhi. And if you ask why the antakarana shuddhi, it's not so that I can get the swargaloka. It's either just for as Ishwara arpana buddhi, as devotion, an expression of my devotion to Ishwara, or it is for gaining the antakarana shuddhi needed for moksha. So that's what we call sattvika tapas. And so here, he talks about it. This first one, shariram tapaha. Shariram means tapas, the sattvika tapas, which is in relationship to the physical body. So he says, deva dvija guru prajna pujanam. So first of all, let's see. Yeah, we can do it. This is fine. Deva means... The last part of this compound, pujanam, means worship, or giving worship, pujanam, doing puja, worshipping, honoring, respecting. the devas, all of the devatas, including Ishvara. So that's that karma yoga buddhi, that Ishvara arpana buddhi, where my buddhi, my commitment really is to the worship or the devotion to Bhagavan, or to the Ishta devatas. So deva, dvija, or the brahmanas in cultural. So the brahmanas are those really who hold the Vedas. They're really the holders of the Vedas, and they're all of the priests. So here it's pujanam, means worship or respect. Pujanam is also respect, holding in high regard, doing seva. The seva for Ishvara would be different forms of puja or worship or chanting or rituals, whatever physical way that we worship the Lord, toward people like the dvijas, brahmanas, or to gurus, your gurus. Your gurus are your teachers. The teachers end with those who give you moksha, those that give you knowledge. But the first teachers are your parents. So matra, pitra. So the first teachers are your parents, and then all of the teachers along the way in your life who have given you something that's of importance, that have helped you. So having a respect, memory, doing seva to those teachers in terms of giving, honoring, and respecting in whatever way, at the appropriate time, whenever that comes up. So that type of... it's okay, Tibby. So that type of honoring. Prajna are just generally those people that are educated and wise. People who are educated, wise, who are contributing something to the culture, who are held in high esteem. Yourself honoring and holding in high esteem those people and respecting them whenever the occasion is there. So it has to do with going anywhere from doing puja to worshiping to honoring to doing seva to giving respect at the appropriate times to these type of people who themselves are the expression of sattva and are doing something to the creation which is really in accordance and in harmony with Bhagavan, with Ishvara, and who have helped you. All of these people are helpful people and helpful to your own maturity along the way. So holding these people in high regard, respecting them at appropriate time in terms of Bhagavan or Ishvara, giving that puja in whatever way is real for you. So that's the deva, dvija, gurus, prajna, those wise people, pujan, and doing that type of honor and respect and worship of those people. This is all shariram, so it means on a physical level, right? We can all do that all mentally, but shariram means how do we act out? How do we act it out? How do we behave toward these people? And for the devatas or toward Ishvara, it would be in terms of karma yoga and Ishvara arpana buddhi, actually doing physical pujas. How do you act? How does it act out in the world? Okay? The shariram tapas. Shauchan means purity, but here, because it's shariram, tapaha, it's physical purity, keeping your body clean, your clothes fresh and clean, your home fresh and clean, your environment fresh and clean, because that physical cleanliness also is going to affect your mind. So keeping that cleanliness on a physical level. Arjavam is straightforwardness, again, in reference to action. Even though when we say arjavam means straightforward, it means straightforwardness between your mind, your speech, and your action. But here the emphasis is put on action, what you physically do. What this means is that what you do should be in true to what you have said, and what you have said should be true to what you think. What's interesting about arjavam is the opposite is not really true. Like, we can think many, 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 many things that we don't say. Right? But what we think, what we say, we should think. Right? See what I mean? So that has to be straightforward. What you may think many things, but what you actually end up saying should be in harmony and a straight arrow, straight line, with what you think. Right? And what you say can be many, many things. You can say many things also. But what you do, the action should be true to what you've said. Like if you say you will do something or that you have done something, that should be true. You know? It shouldn't contradict, your actions should not be contradict what you have said. That makes sense? So that's kind of that straightness. Arjava means that which is straight, means there's a straight line. There's a huge amount of freedom in that straight line because there's no contradiction anywhere. You're not contradicting. And so your mind is always free. There are no lies. You know, there's no lie, there's no deception. And so that's a beautiful quality about Arjava. A lie, any type of a lie, or an action which you have to cover up. You know, you did this and you say you didn't do it. Or you say you were going to do this, but that you didn't. But it was important that you do it. And then you could start lying to cover that up or hope nobody finds out, you know. And then you can say something when you're thinking the opposite. You think that's a lie. Right? Say you say something, but the opposite is true. Then the mind is confused. Everything is confused. It's very hard to remember all of this. You know, lying is hard to remember because it's not based in anything. It's only based in the lie. It's not based in the reality. Then you have to remember which things you said. What was the lie that you told about this thing that you did? And who did you tell which lie to? Or were you consistent in the lie? It was very complicated. And so we've all had our experience with lying, and it's a very, it teaches you the problems of the, that any type of dishonesty teaches you not to do it. It creates a lot of conflict inside. So that's the Arjava. It's really a beautiful one to contemplate on. The one good contemplation is to imagine if you go back your whole life, you remember all of the shortcomings, if they pop out to you, what would it be like to have a life that was straight arrow from your birth to now? That mind has no conflicts. There's a beautiful dharma, beautiful integrity in that mind. And so whatever little crooked things are there, to the degree that they can be straightened out, that's a beautiful thing. The ones that can't be straightened out because they're too far in the past or whatever, then, you know, that's just, I've learned from that. The ones that are closer to the present that you can straighten out, nice to do. The others you just view as a teacher, you know. These things don't contribute to my strength, to my inner strength. They don't contribute to the confusing, to the buddhi. The buddhi is the one that holds all of the values and also makes the decisions. The buddhi is the one that holds knowledge. And so when the buddhi is having to negotiate these lies that are hung up in the manas, really, it becomes a big, big, big and very unpleasant job. So Arjava is one to spend time on. Brahmacharya, remember here, the Arjava is really being looked at on a physical level, so that what you do should be true to what you have said. You said you're going to do it, then you should definitely do it. And then if you said you're going to do it, you should do it. If you said you have done it, you should have done it. Otherwise, you have to say, I'm sorry, I didn't do that. I should have done that. That's Arjava. Right at physical level. You're supposed to, you're required to do it. You know, you failed in that. But then how do you failed to that in that it goes against what you've said. And so now what you have to do is change what you've said. I said that I would do that. I'm sorry, I wasn't able to. I didn't. That's Arjava, right? It's first failure that is corrected by correcting what you had said you would do. See what I mean? So this is a Shariram Tapas. The next one here, last one is for, again, Shariram means belonging to the physical body, is Ahimsa. Ahimsa means non-injury at a physical level, which means that on a mental level, that wanting to hurt, that desire to hurt, is there in the mind. But the Ahimsa, it means it can take place in the mind. The Ahimsa is your Dhamma. Dhamma means, you know, Shama Dhamma. Dhamma means your ability, because of your value system, to restrain from that ahimsa. It means that you are not willing, no matter what's going on in your mind, you have the Dhamma to constrain your acting out of that himsa. Of that himsa means wanting to hurt, injury, the desire or the inclination to hurt. Shama is where that is, if it comes in the mind, it would be dismissed. That's shama, means you can let it go. Dhamma is when the inclination is there to hurt on a physical level, the ability to restrain that. Swamiji uses in his commentary, which is a really beautiful commentary, if you haven't read this section of it, you should read it. It says, even the ahimsa on a physical level should be toward all beings. And then he talks for two paragraphs about the life of an ant. That comes a little later about how they handle it day-to-day, but he mentions ant here, I think, and then talks for a couple of paragraphs a little later. If you see an insect, you say you ant, or you see an insect that you don't want to be in your home, right? Then you can swat it, you know, which is an unconscious act. Or you can pick it up and save it and take it outside. That's ahimsa. The ahimsa, that non-injury, includes the way you treat living creatures and the way you treat plants and the way you treat animals. And Swamiji talks about this, which he talks always about it in terms of being vegan or vegetarian, is that there's a definite himsa whether you have performed that act or not in the eating of animal food or even in the ingesting of dairy or cheese or anything like that, because of by your sanctioning that, you're sanctioning what has happened to those animals to get that food on your plate. What has happened? And so just because you didn't physically have to do it, you're directly involved in the killing or the abuse of that animal. And so most people will not look at that at all. And so Amji says, you know, you can be a good and sensitive person and still be involved in this killing of animals in this way. But and that's true. And there are also Brahmins and vegans and vegetarians who have also been very violent. That's also true. But nevertheless, acknowledging all of that as a fact, and we all know that as a fact, there is an insensitivity involved in participating in this killing of animals. There's an insensitivity and there's a cultural conditioning or whatever it is that allows allows you not to relate to this fact. It's something that keeps you, there's a something that allows you to, your defense system allows you to keep in the dark about what's actually happening with this killing and slaughter of animals who themselves don't want to die. They don't want to be killed, they don't want to be abused, they don't want to be put in small cages, etc., etc., etc. And so it takes a lot of... something inside of you has to be willing to look at it. And that's the first step, is to be willing to look at it. Once you're willing to actually look at it, then your buddhi will follow. The buddhi means the one that decides about between dharma and adharma. The buddhi will follow once you allow yourself to actually look at the situation honestly, at what's being done. We are in such a cultural soup, if you want to call it culture, I don't think it's culture. We're in such a societal soup that has generations behind it, you know, that we're raised in such a way where we don't have to look at these things because it's all packaged for us in a different way. You know, it's packaged for us in a way that's palatable, so we don't have to look at, we don't have to know, we don't have to see what's really happening. And we've grown up with generations of being able to push it out of our mind. But that itself causes an insensitivity, and it causes an insensitivity. So I think that's true. I have been through all of that myself, from the insensitivity to the wanting to remain insensitive, to not really wanting to know, you know, keeping it at bay because it would change my lifestyle too much. It was too radical to make certain changes. You know, so I just kept it at bay, made these little inroads, being a vegetarian and all of this, but kept other things at bay, not wanting to look at them, not wanting to look at what happened to animals when to get the leather for your shoes or your leather bags, not wanting to think about it, keeping it at bay. But as soon as I started letting it in,
mm-hmm.
you know, then your buddhi is no longer going to allow you to make those choices. And so then you become more sensitive because you're more sensitive because you're not being sheltered by the defense system that doesn't want you to have to confront these things because it is inconvenient. It is socially inconvenient. You know? It is fashionably inconvenient. It's inconvenient when you go out with friends. It's inconvenient when you want your favorite foods that have to do with cheese and dairy, etc. It's inconvenient. We have food addictions. We don't want to break the food addictions. So many food addictions. It's all inconvenient. We don't want to be bothered. But once you decide, I am going to be bothered, you change inside. And it's worth it. But you have to overcome so many addictions before you realize the fruit of saying no to all of these things. You know? They're incredible social, I call them addictions. Because once you break the addiction, it doesn't matter at all. You're glad you're not doing it. You know? But so it's an addiction to different ways of life and different foods that we eat and different clothes that we wear. It's on endless addictions. I see it as that it's a Rakshasa culture, generations of a Rakshasa culture, Rakshasa Asura culture that we're born in. And so our minds are totally ensconced in accepting some things that are in fact deep, dark adharma. And it takes a lot of strength, a lot of courage, a lot of discipline, a lot of understanding, a lot of study to actually say no to it all. So we hear this from Swamiji all the time. He even talked about it. He's still talking about it. You know? He talked about it even when I was meeting with him privately. This last time I was there, he was talking about how, I can't remember exactly what brought it up, but he was talking about the different ways. Somehow something came up and I said, Swamiji's always talked about being a vegetarian, you know, in his classes. And he said, something must have come up to trigger that, that made me say that you've always talked about this as long as I've known you.
Mm-hmm.
And Swamiji said something like, yes, I have different ways of talking about it, you know. I find different ways to talk about it. Sometimes I'll talk about it with a kind of a heavy punch, to shock, kind of shock people into understanding. Other times I talk about it very, very gently, you know, to try to make people just understand, you know, in their mind, to appreciate, to understand intellectually. He said, I find myself, depending upon the situation, I'm putting some words in his mouth, but more or less, I find myself talking about this in different ways because I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want to hurt anybody, but at the same time, it's something very important to understand. And so, he's always emphasized it. So, that's the shariram, tapas, okay? Tapas on a physical level, and he brings in ahimsa there. Let's do the next one, which is the vajtapas. Anudvegataram vakyam, satyam priyahitam chayat. Satyam priyahitam chayat. Swadhyaya vyasanam chaiva. Swadhyaya vyasanam chaiva. Vang mayam tapa uchate. Vang mayam tapa uchate. Anudvega karam vakyam satyam priya hitam cha yat swadhyaya abhyasanam cha eva vakmayam tapaha uchyate. He says that tapaha uchyate, vakmayam tapaha uchyate. Tapas, which concerns the vak, vagmayam, means comprised of speech. So these religious austerities comprised of speech, vak, are said to be what? He says, anudvegakaram vakyam. Those statements, vakyam means a statement or a sentence, the words that come out of your mouth, okay, vakyam. Those vakyams which are anudvegakaram, which do not cause agitation, which are not upsetting, you know, anudvegakaram vakyam. So words that are, udvega means something that gives you the shakes or agitates you or is upsetting to you. Unudvega karam, words that don't do this, words that don't agitate, upset, or hurt you. So anudvega karam vakyam. And those words must be, use those non-upsetting, non-agitating words, they should be satyam. They should be true, right? It shouldn't be a lie. They should be words that are true, and those true words should be anudvega, non-agitating. And not only should they be true and non-agitating, they must also be priya and hitam. Priya means they should be pleasing. They should be loving. They should be pleasing. And they should be hitam. Hitam means they should be beneficial and useful. In Shankara, in his commentary, he says, of these words, it has to be all four. Like, say, the words were true, but they were agitating and hurtful. No, that's not vaktapas. Say they were true, but they were not hitam. Like, say, he uses the example of, say, for a gambler, you know, there's a poker game going on around the corner. And so he tells his friend, listen, there's a wonderful poker game going on around the corner. Now, that's not agitating. It's also true, right? It's very pleasing, right? Well, but it's not hitam. It's not in the best interest of that person. So like that, all four of these have to be in apply. Usually they don't say this anudvega karam. They just say satyam, hitam, and priyam is vaktapas. Here he adds this anudvega karam. It doesn't agitate. Doesn't cause agitation or worry or concern. And he actually gives, I think Shankara, let me just see if I can find this here. For this type of speech, he quotes something in one of the Upanishads, I believe, where the teacher tells to his student who is agitated and kind of acting out and whatnot. He says it like this: Shantaha bhava vatsa, oh dear child, vatsa means oh dear child, may you have shanti, may you be peaceful, shantaha bhava, may you be peaceful. Swadhyayam yogam cha anutishta. He says, may you be peaceful. You do your swadhyaya. You study the Vedas and do your karma yoga. Swadhyaya and karma yoga here means karma yoga. Do your swadhyaya, do your study of the Vedas, and do yoga. May you have shanti in your mind. And he says, and that will be good for you. That will bless you. Instead of saying, shut up! You know, that's the Swamiji. Shut up! Keep quiet! Do what I tell you to do. He says, oh dear child, you know, may you have some shanti. It's good for you to do your swadhyaya and to do your karma yoga. This will bless you. That's an example of that's an example that Shankara gives of this vaktapas. Okay? So here also he says, swadhyaya abhyasanam. For the vaktapas, the continual study of the swadhyaya of the Vedas, for us it would be a continual study of the Upanishads. That abhyasanam means, you know, you continually study. For a brahmana, they would continually be chanting the Vedas. They would be chanting the Vedas every day, studying the Vedas. For us, every day, we're studying, whatever we do, the Upanishads, the Prakarana Granthas, bringing to mind, spending time doing the sadhana every day. Study. That's swadhyaya abhyasanam. He says, this very thing is what we call vanmaya tapaha vaktapas. So, very, very beautiful.
What's it called?
He says vanmayam tapaha. That maya is an affix. It means comprised of. So tapas, which is comprised of speech, which is in this form. Anudvega karam, so that your vakyam, your sentences are not agitating, they're satyam, they're priya, they're pleasing, they're useful. And also also you spend time on a daily basis. You spend time on a daily basis. Abhyasana means continually, you know, as part of your practice, you know, studying the Vedas. Abhyasana, repeating the Vedas. So now we've done shariram tapaha and vangmayam tapaha. And the next one is mental, manasa. So let's do this one. Manat prasadasya mitvam. Maunam atma vinigraha. Maunam atma vinigraha. Bhavasam shuddhiritjetat. Tapo manasamuchyate. Manas prasadaha. Saumyatvam. Maunam atma vinigraha. Bhava samshuddhi iti etat tapaha. Manasam uchate. So tapo manasam uchate. This is called the manasa tapas. The tapas which is born of the mind, that is in reference to the mind. First one, mana prasadaha. The mana prasada means that the mind enjoys a prasada buddhi, which it enjoys cheerfulness, a certain sense of cheerfulness, a sense of freedom. Swamiji has a couple of pages on this for the Manasa Prasada. What he's talking about is what he has taught so often, I always use as an example, to be able to live one day at a time. To live one day, and then he'll say, actually it's not just one day at a time, we're taking a big chunk, they're one day at a time. It's more one moment at a time. This is how you live your life, dealing with what there is to be done at this moment. You know, with that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. To really be able to do this, you have to have an understanding of Ishvara. Because otherwise, the creation is just an inert creation, and it's really up to you. The only intelligence here is you. And that intelligence is coming into relationship with other little limited intelligences. It's just as a physical inert creation. And so there's this, what's going to happen to me? And so it's a perfect setup. What's going to happen to me? How's my future going to unfold? Well, let me just live one moment at a time. Well, it's an inert one moment at a time. But what if you really, as you start to understand the prarabdha karma, the very karmas that have given you this birth, to understand that this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of Ishvara, of a much greater intelligence than yours is. Sometimes we use the example of, you know, just like a little cell in this body, you know, going up the bloodstream, say a little blood cell going up the bloodstream, decides, oh my God, where are we going? What's going to happen to me? I think I should go the other way. You know, I think I've made a wrong turn. I should go the other way. There's no understanding that it is part and parcel of something much greater than itself and is held together by a much greater network of laws and order of which it is a part. And so as this vision starts to take root and you really understand that this creation really is a manifestation of the Satchitananda of your very being, like, that there's not somebody else here, that this whole creation, this infinite creation, is in fact you, and this little body, this jiva, is part and part and parcel of that bigger you, of that bigger limitless intelligence. And in fact, this whole thing, this also is great for Antakarana Shuddhi, for this understanding. Every moment of your experience is a moment of you, right? And in terms of the prarabdha karma, why is this body, mind, sense organs, this jiva, find itself here in the middle of this situation, right? Whatever the situation may be, this is your situation. This is a complexity of the antakarana, you can say, of the antakarana, of the you that this body is part of, right? This body, mind, sense organs, is part of the whole infinite creation, but what is it allowed to experience through this limited mind and sense organs? And so you're experiencing, this jiva is experiencing like a small little section of yourself, right? Of the Ishwara Upadhi, which is nothing but you. Because Ishwara is a manifestation of your being. You are the Satchitananda. You are the self of Ishwara. Right? Ishwara doesn't have another self. Ishwara is mitya. Ishwara is maya. Ishwara, as maya, as mitya, has its sole reality is really the Satchitananda, which is you. And so this creation is a manifestation of your being, and this jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, is a part of that infinite manifestation. And so the truth of the whole thing in terms of the jiva should be and is really, let me be present and do my dharma, because in doing your dharma, that is Ishwara. Doing your dharma in any given situation is a pranam of the jiva. The jiva pranams, lays down its head to Ishwara in the doing of dharma. And in your doing of dharma, actually, is absolutely natural to you, to the jiva, because natural to Ishwara, it is natural to you, except when some form of raga dvesha comes in, which is what the jiva has to contribute to Ishwara. We say the whole Ishwara manifestation, we have Ishwara Srishti, which is Brahman with the maya that manifests as the whole creation. That's Ishwara's creation. Ishwara Srishti means creation, so Ishwara Srishti. And then, upon the Ishwara Srishti, all the jivas are included in the Ishwara Srishti. The jivas have the capacity to create also. That's the jiva Srishti. That's what we call paribhasika, the subjective projection that we put upon the world. And that subjective projection often has much to do with our raga dvesha, either subtle or physical, our likes and dislikes. And so when I project my likes and dislikes upon the creation, then the jiva is born, then the jiva is up and active. I want this, not this. I want this person to be like this, not like this. Right? That's the raga dvesha that's projected on the creation. And then I'm acting off of that because I will always go toward the Satchitananda, ananda being that emphasized. I will always go toward my own nature. And my own nature is Satchitananda. The jiva always goes toward your own nature, which is Satchitananda. The problem is the Satchitananda is projected out onto the world. So this world exists, but it is finite, so I have to protect it. This body exists, but it is finite, I have to protect it, right? In terms of ananda, in terms of chit, I have to go on increasing my knowledge because I'm not all knowledge. I have to keep gaining knowledge, chit. Keep increasing my consciousness. Right? I'm the consciousness which is the self of the entire creation, but as a jiva, I don't know that, so I have to keep accruing my accruing consciousness, accruing knowledge. Ananda? Ananda, there is nothing more important than Ananda. But an Ananda means that I be loved, that all be well with me. Nobody cares about fulfilling desires. They they care about gaining the Ananda, which they expect to come from the fulfillment of the desire. That Ananda is also projected out. And so I am running out continually because of Ajnanam. I'm continually running out after myself. And that causes a rub with Dharma. Because of the Raga Dvesha, I think I need this to be happy. But if the Dharma is just going on, the Prarabdha Karma is going on its own merry way as Ishwara is unfolding. But I've decided that it's not supposed to go that way. It's supposed to go this way. Because I have projected some raga, some desire upon it. And then I have to stop things. I have to stop things from going in the way that they're going. And sometimes that creates an adharma on my part. I can speak harshly. I can act out. I can become violent. I can become deceptive. I can do all kinds of things to try to manipulate Ishwara into providing something that I think I need for my own well-being. When that need isn't there, then my natural inclination is to be helpful, to just do what is there to be done. Because your nature, what you are as a healthy being, is Satchitananda Atma, and you follow the laws of Dharma, which pervade the whole universe. And so Dharma is what is natural to you. A Dharma is more natural to the Raga Dvesha, unfulfilled Raga Dvesha, likes and dislikes, born of Ajnana, born of self-ignorance. And so when I'm not being tested, I naturally have natural Shanti and natural inclination toward Dharma because those are the laws which are most natural to me. And so here this Manas Prasada, that buddhi, that mind that is naturally cheerful, that enjoys that cheerfulness, is a mind that doesn't have a need for things to be different. Rather, it has a need, let me do my best in this situation. I see the situation as Ishwara. And so that's Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, where my mind naturally respects or is in worship of Ishwara. Means I can't just worship Ishwara, and Ishwara I don't know. You can't just worship somebody. That worship is born of a knowledge. The knowledge of this is an infinite expression of myself, and everything here is really only my being. This body is everything I've experienced is Ishwara, this body is Ishwara, this mind is Ishwara, the whole thing is Ishwara. And so here I find myself as a jiva in the middle of this. This is Ishwara, this is Ishwara. Let me live moment to moment and do my dharma every moment. Let me live day to day and do what is given to me every day. If there's planning to be done today, it's time to plan something, let me plan. Right? If I do something, if I made a mistake yesterday, let me learn from that mistake today. Let me not worry about the mistake I made yesterday. Let me learn from that mistake today, be grateful that I will not make that mistake again tomorrow. So that gives an incredible cheerfulness of mind because actually the response of that mind can rest very lightly. The burden is gone. I can make huge burdens for myself, when out of my own raga dvesha and I need this to be like this and this to be like this in order to be happy. But really for a jivan mukta, for a jnani, what happens is there really is no jiva. The jiva has surrendered to Ishwara. So the jiva is not, there's nothing in that jiva to want to raise its head. As long as the jiva is there, as long as the prarabdha is there until the body drops, that jiva is there, but there's too much knowledge, there's no one there that wants to raise its head. That's why when Swamiji, this time he was talking about the Dakshinamurti, and actually, Swamiji was doing an overview of this very chapter. He was doing some of 16, but this chapter is what he was doing. And he finished the whole chapter in just a few days because he's doing a 3-month overview for the students at the course. Now, at the end of this month, the Sthemath overview was over. So I'm sure he's well into chapter 18 and will finish it by the end of the month. So anyway, he does this chapter 17. So in the light of this chapter, he brought up the Dakshinamurti, who has his foot on the Upasmata. Upasmata is the one who has forgotten. Swamiji, the one who can't remember. So the Swamiji talks about the one, about all of the stuff that is in the unconscious. All of that self-forgetfulness. When all of the values get overwhelmed. You know, all of your values get overwhelmed. Self-knowledge is not there. Ignorance is there. Unconscious material comes and overwhelms. Dakshinamurti is sitting, you know, with his mudra, with his foot on this apasmara. And it's such a... And he's not violently. Just apasmara is there, you know, down. And Dakshinamurti just has his foot gently sitting on top of it, you know. And that means the apasmara, all of these unconscious things, all of these habits, you know, that need to be transformed, all of them are held in check or contained by Dakshinamurti, by one's buddhi that is nothing but knowledge. So if Dakshinamurti is the first teacher, he is nothing but the manifestation of knowledge. And so all of this unconscious material or all of this ajnanam and the results of ajnanam, the adharmas that we've done, all of those now really, if as they wiggle, because they may wiggle, they wiggle in the light of the buddhi. They can't overwhelm the buddhi. The buddhi means your knowledge, in fact, overwhelms it. The buddhi is so strong, your knowledge and your knowledge and your dharma is so strong that the wiggling of the apasmata only is tickling Dakshinamurti's foot. There's nothing more than that. And so that's our maturity. As we mature, what is happening in terms of our knowledge, the buddhi, your knowledge becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, which gives a container, a holding container for all of the habits and all of the unconscious, you know, pressures and all of the raga dveshas that initially want to act out. Those over time become less and less and less until finally they're just kind of relaxed down there underneath Bhagavan's foot, underneath the strength of the whole buddhi. So that's a kind of a beautiful image to have. Huh. That these forces that we have when you come to knowledge, the forces of the apasmara, you know, is the one who's acting out often. The apasmara, you know, that one, all the unconscious material, all your raga dveshas are what often are driving. They can be driving the buddhi. They're overwhelming the buddhi. But because of dharma, because of the karma yoga buddhi, because of the mumukshutvam, the buddhi starts gaining strength. When the buddhi gains a certain amount of strength, it has the space to become a mumukshu. Right? Until then, the buddhi is weaker than the apasmara. It's weaker than the raga dveshas. It's weaker than your instincts. It's weaker than the values that are the adharmic values. I don't call the adharmas that have not been replaced by dharma. Adharmic ways of being, like in the chapter 16 when we went through all of the, what we call the Asuri Sampat. Remember chapter 16 is the Asuri Sampat. He gives three verses for the Suri Sampat, means the values that are really dharmic, that they belong to Ishwara. The values that are natural to Ishwara, the values that are natural to the devatas, those are looked at in the last half of 15 and the very beginning of 16. But the rest of 16, chapter 16, is all on the Asuri Sampat, those values that are the values of an Asura, of a Rakshasa, the values that go in the face of dharma. And so those values, those misguided values that we, maybe we were born into them because of our parents, we picked them up along the way, whatever it is, those things have become the values that are controlling the buddhi. There comes a time, though, when those values, one just through experience, through one's experience or through one's teachers, those values become less valued than the Dhyanasamput. And then those asuric values need to be transformed. And they go through a process of transformation as my buddhi becomes strong in the Dhyanasamput, those values which are dharma, those values that are based in dharma. And as the buddhi becomes strong with dharma, with its mumukshutvam, with its knowledge, then these values dissipate. These values are transformed into dharma. Unconscious problems that we have or unconscious pains that we have from growing up, those become like scars rather than bleeding pustules. They become scars which are actually useful for our empathy. These scars, the scars and the hurts that we've overcome, are our strength and our compassion and our empathy for other beings. So they actually have, they give us our character, they have a beauty. Until they're healed, they cause us a tremendous amount of pain. But once they become small, and something easily handled by the buddhi, then they become points of understanding. Just think of, if you were to be a therapist, you're a therapist, but you've never had any problems. Never any problems, never any conflicts, parents were perfect, grew up with no strife, nothing to work out, and then you're supposed to be helpful. You're supposed to be helpful to your clients, to your patients, but you can't relate because you've never had the experience. You have no idea. You don't know what that is. You can't imagine it. It's kind of a made up fantasy. Okay, it's hard to imagine, but if you take it to the extreme, how would the person understand? They've never had such an experience. So that process of growth is a beautiful process, but it will boil down to the freedom to allow Ishwara to be Ishwara. To allow Ishwara to be Ishwara is to give space to all beings and to welcome all beings. And even more than that, to welcome all beings, to realize that all of these beings are only me. They're only me. There's not another being here. There's only one being here. And I can welcome all of you. It's really as much as you can say, I can welcome this whole body and I will tend to all of the parts that are hurt. My body. Because this is my body, right? So I welcome this whole body, I can love this body, and I can take care of all of the parts that need special attention, that need to be. So I can do a meditation like that. I welcome you, my body. I welcome all of you. All the things that I will take care of you. Yeah. And all of the parts of you that were hurt are hurting, I will give special attention. I will take care of you. You are all welcome to be, every part of you is welcome to be with me. Okay. Now we have to say that toward the universe. For the entirety of my experience, I welcome all of you. Okay. I'll help in any way I can. I welcome you. You can be with me. That's a wonderful sadhana. So the next time somebody comes up that you can't stand to have near you, see what it's like. But see what that sadhana is like inside, to say, I'll do some guided meditations on this. Like I did some actually this weekend, when I was in India this time. To really say, to imagine that person and say, I welcome you. When you welcome is the opposite of pushing away. So when you welcome, it means that you're not rejecting this person. And if you can't do it, which maybe the mind will go, no, I'm not ready for that. I'm not going to do that. Then you need to really welcome the one who can't do that. So I understand you're not able to do that, and I welcome you. And then the dialogue is with that one that just can't do it. Remember I told you about that story, about that and I was involved in the very first course here in the early 80s, and there was that one person who caused me so much pain, so much problem, and Swamiji would go to Swamiji, because I could not overcome it. I just couldn't. And he would call me and say, you just go and say one nice word to that person. Just one nice word and go on your way. I could not. You know? It took like 3 days of him pushing me. And then finally, I was able to do it, and it was such relief. I just said something nice and walked by. That's all. And this knot inside of me released. I couldn't believe it. And then I did it the next day. There was still resistance. I did it the next day. I ended up doing it 3 or 4 times. Nothing. Just walking by saying something nice. Every time that happened. And then somehow I overcame whatever it was. Well, I overcame it. But it was wonderful. The wonderful thing was that I realized the strength, the magic of this. So then it became really part of my sadhana. So that if I would feel that way, I would make I would do an action. This is that tapas, the shariram tapas. I would do a physical action, and it would just blow it apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is that. Pratipaksha bhavana that Swamiji always talks about. Usually we don't always think to do it like giving a rose to somebody who's your greatest enemy, give them a rose every day. That's just an example for doing something physical. But if we can't do it physical, we can work to do it mentally and imaginally. And if we can't do it imaginally, we need to spend time with the little one inside who is so hurt. Because when that's the case, the hurt really isn't about this person. It's about somebody that's hurt inside. And that dyad is being projected out onto this situation because no one's going inside and taking care of the one who's hurt inside. You know? Otherwise it won't be that strong. Just this person is a problem, this person is irritating, this person is, oh my God, how do they survive? Poor wife or whatever. You know? It's not holding you. If it's holding you, and you can't do a simple exercise to break it, then we have to respect that, and we have to go inside, and find out what's going on with that little one, and how that one is being hurt, and how that one was hurt in the past, and what's the injustice that's been done, what's the trauma that's been done. That is holding so much hurt and pain. So that little one then becomes the one to welcome and spend a lot of time with. Right? Because that's the one who needs you. That's the one who's acting out. You say, you know, we have the terrible twos, we have the teenager, we have all these different parts. They are screaming for your attention. That's what they're doing. And they want to be loved. It's not about this. It's not about knocking off this guy or whatever it is, knocking off this person. It's about giving this little one, being on this little one's side and realizing, you know, that this little one needs to be loved and respected. He or she needs to have a voice, you know, needs to be believed, needs to be given the benefit of the doubt, you know. All of these things that needs to, for you to know, you know, that he or she is really a really good person, a good little boy, a good little girl, you know, that's very smart and intelligent, and a perfect little child. Like all little babies, little children are perfect little children, they're perfect little babies, and they need their parents to look at them that way. And the natural instincts is for the parents to look at that child in that way. But there's no cuter baby. This baby, this is the cutest baby. They can say, I know there's cuter babies. There's so many cute babies, but I could never feel that anybody's cuter and more beautiful than my little baby. That's how it is. You know? I feel that way about little Tibby. There's so many beautiful cats. There's so many beautiful, wonderful cats. But Tibby is Tibby. I feel that way about my little nephew. Cutest little boy. Can't imagine what a cute little boy. He's such a wonderful, little boy. But that's natural. That's what's natural. But you don't always get that. Because parents are tired or we don't know what's happened. When you don't get that, there's a wounding. And so now, we have to go in and we have to give it. And we can give it. And those parts can be healed in a very beautiful way. We do have scar tissue, but we're so much bigger than the scar tissue. You know, that's the great thing. Nice thin scars. No pus, no wound. It's all is well. But we have to do this. We have to do this work. So Swamiji's also commented, even when I was listening to the talks, chapter 17 that he was doing, why does Krishna spend so much time, chapter 15, chapter 16, now chapter 17, and when we get into 18, all to do with the sattva, rajas, and tamas, all to do with the sattva buddhi, the rajas buddhi, the tamas buddhi, so that for antikarma shuddhi, he goes to great lengths about what to look for, how to gain this, to gain the tools for antikarma shuddhi, because the antikarma, the mind, is the vehicle that's going to gain and hold and enjoy this knowledge. And so we come to this knowledge with a shuddhi. It means there's thing with it has its own problems. It comes with its host, with the mind having its host of problems. Every mind does. But these problems, the fundamental knowledge will eradicate the fundamental problem of projecting everything onto the world. But there's a lot of values and habitual problems and
lack
unconscious material, all kinds of things that are causing a lot of agitation and hurt in the mind. And so we need to have the tools to be able to train the mind, to heal the mind, and to also train it with proper values. But that's why Swamiji wrote that book, Value of Values. You can't just give the Ten Commandments. It's not good enough. Every value that you have has to be integrated. Yes, has to be understood. So it's your value, not somebody else's value. You have a value for it because it brings depth and shanti to your mind. You know? So there's nothing more important than that. No amount of fulfilling your desires gives, you know, a lasting shanti in the mind. And so the antikarma shuddhi that work, the work of antikarma shuddhi, the work, the care, the love of the antikarma, becomes as important as the shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana is the means for gaining this knowledge, the unfoldment, the understanding. But then the antikarma, the mind, has to, we have to be able to release it of its hurts and its pains. And its lack of values. That we have to do that work. It's as important. Right? Because this knowledge is the vehicle for gaining and holding. And this antikarma is the vehicle for gaining this knowledge. And so we want a mind that can enjoy it, that can gain it and enjoy it. So that's why Shankara with his commentaries, but Krishna spends, how many chapters on it? 15, 16, 17, and most of 18. That's after he's taught the whole Gita. These values have come in throughout, but now he's just sitting there on this because it's important. So, all right, let's stop. swasti prajapya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimmahishaha ko pramanedya shubhamasti nityam loka samastha sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyaha pratidesasya shalini desho yam chobarahitaha Brahmanasantu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma saggamaya Tamaso ma jyotir gamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Arihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Arihi Om.
Pratibhasika is a part of Ishvara.
Mm-hmm. That's like saying the jiva is part of Ishvara, right?
Yes.
So
yeah.
Pratibhasika is part of the jiva, but there's nothing that's not part of Ishvara.
Yes.
So Pratibhasika comes from the jiva's mind, but the jiva's mind is all contained within the laws of Ishvara, as is projection all contained within the laws of Ishvara. But the source of the Pratibhasika is the mind of the jiva. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. But still, everything's Ishvara.
The source of everything else that isn't Pratibhasika of that particular jiva is
Ishvara.
Sourced by Ishvara or other jiva?
No. Say like this. There are the laws of the creation that are not subjective, means there's the projection of the creation that is not subjective, that's called vyavahara. It means that's shared, the shared experience of all beings. And so if you were to go and to analyze all of these laws and these structures, and somebody else was too, it would be there to be analyzed. Whereas you couldn't really go in and analyze somebody else's dream. You couldn't enter into that experience because it's Pratibhasika. You could talk to somebody about it, but you're not an entity within their dream. See what I mean? So that's what we mean by subjective. It's not being shared. The subjective reality still exists within the laws of Ishvara. There's nothing outside of Ishvara. The whole jiva is part of Ishvara. But some experiences are only subjective, while other experiences are objective. So the object of experiences means shared. That's what we call vyavaharata. The subjective Pratibhasika experiences are not shared. That would be like your emotions, your projections, your imaginations, your dreams. Those are not shared by somebody else. You can tell them about it and they can experience you're reacting to them, but they're not experiencing it. Good example is rope snake. The rope is shared. We can all see the rope, but the projected snake is not shared. That's Pratibhasika. But that we can project a snake is vyavahara. Right? That's why we can talk about projections and talk about Pratibhasika, because that's a shared phenomena. The world has a place for it, but it's still subjective, not objective. Objective means we can all experience it. Make sense?
Another quick one, hopefully. Karma Yoga Buddhi and Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, are they synonyms?
They can be.
Very similar?
They're very similar.
It seems like they're
synonymous. We can say one or the other, because the Ishvara Arpana Buddhi means that conviction or that commitment to worship Ishvara. But then what does it mean to worship Ishvara? We can say the worship of Ishvara really takes place in the following of Dharma. Okay? So the Ishvara Arpana Buddhi really is the practice of Dharma, recognizing Dharma itself as Ishvara, as the kind of the warp and woof of Ishvara. So that's the... Now when we say that Karma Yoga Buddhi, it gets a little... There's a difference there, though we are talking about Karma Yoga when we say both of them. But now when I say the Karma Yoga Buddhi, that's when I take all the karmas that are done, I take the karma as the result of that action. So one way of looking at karma, the result of the action, with that prasada buddhi. So the prasada, Ishvara Arpana Buddhi and prasada buddhi belong to that karma yoga. One is I see my whole life is really a worship of Ishvara, which means is devoted to Dharma. I can't be devoted to Dharma without being devoted to Ishvara. I don't even know what Dharma is without knowing what Ishvara is. So I'm operationalizing that worship of Ishvara, where my life is committed to Dharma, not to Raga Dvesha, not to my likes and dislikes. If my likes and dislikes fall within Dharma, that's fine. There's no conflict. You know, it's not like I shouldn't have likes and dislikes, but what do I act out? What do I act upon? I can act upon all those likes that are in consonance with Dharma, because then there's no conflict. But if there's a choice between Dharma and Adharma, I will always choose Dharma, because my commitment is to Ishvara.
So they're really two different things, but both lead to Shanti.
Yes, this one leads to Shanti, and then accepting that what we call the Prasada Buddhi, right? Prasada Buddhi is where I receive all of the results of my actions as prasad. So these two things together are really the Karma Yoga Buddhi. There's one other aspect to it, which we call Kaushalam. Kaushalam has to do with, and Krishna talks about this in the chapter 2, maybe the last half of chapter 2, but Kaushalam is where I have gained a certain skill in action, where I have the skill to determine what is appropriate action in a given situation. So that's a certain skill to be able to know what is the appropriate way to respond in this situation. And that Kaushalam Buddhi we keep increasing. You know, what is appropriate behavior in this situation? So that takes experience. Takes experience, teaching, you know, following my parents, following if they were dharmis, following people who I respect as being dharmanishtas, just the integrating our experience so that I gain a skill to handle situations appropriately. So that Kaushalam is an aspect of it also. But primarily we talk about the Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, where my commitment is to Dharma, not my Raga Dvesha, and then to the Prasada Buddhi, which is accepting all of the results of my actions as prasad from the Lord. Because with the understanding that in anything you do, say you have a desire and you take an action to fructify or actualize that desire, there are so many other forces at play besides the action you've taken to gain that desired object, that you have to realize that you're not really you're the karta, but it's only, and compared to all of the other forces that are involved, you know, your action is very minuscule. Otherwise you would say, whatever I want, I can get. I want this, I do this, I get it. And there's Swamiji do a long story about two people living in the same area, the same upbringing, the same education, the same amount of money. One starts with one business, the other starts the business. They both start the same business. But one is highly successful, and one flops completely because of outside forces. For this one, everything fell into place. For this one, it didn't. You know? So, why? It's not like this was a good person, this was a bad person. or this one didn't, this one made prayatna, proper effort, and this one didn't make proper effort. They both made proper effort. But there's too many variables. It's not just about you, you know? And so you make, you do, if there's something that you want, you accept the kartrutva and the doership, because you don't, karma yoga is for somebody who doesn't really have knowledge, self-knowledge yet. Assimilated self-knowledge. For the one, assimilated self-knowledge is only Ishwara. There's no karta. It's just Bhagavan. Even everything that you would think is the karta, the buddhi, the doer, that's all Ishwara. So the whole doership resolves. But until that doership resolves, then what is so close, very, very close to that jnanam buddhi, that buddhi that really has knowledge, is where you, the karta is totally really pranamin to Ishwara. So because of attitude. And so that karta is becoming very, what do you call it, porous, or very...
malleable?
No, but when you spread something out so it doesn't, it's not so strong, you know? Forget the word for it, but it becomes very... Yeah, you're stretching out. It becomes very dilute. You know, it's not quite the... diffuse. It becomes very diffuse. It doesn't have... any power for you, because you've given all of your devotion and commitment to Ishwara. And so even though that sense of doership is there, your attitude toward Ishwara and toward the results of all your action and your commitment to Dharma makes the effects of the doership negligible. The mind still maintains shanti because you're accepting the results of the action. Your commitment is to Dharma, so you'll give up any adharma for the sake of dharma, and you accept with a prasada buddhi all of the results of your action. So you still have the shanti, maybe the same shanti that the jnani has. It's just for the jnani that that sense of kartrutva has also been given up to Ishwara.
It seems to me...
Which is kind of just the final resolution.
It seems to me, in what you just described, you have to have a lot of confidence that Ishwara will look after or care for you or for himself.
Yes, but you're talking like the Christian God. See, the there, and this is problematic because we look at, if you're raised in the West within a Judeo-Christian paradigm, more so Christian than Jewish, because the Jewish paradigm hasn't really divided the God image into Satan over here and Christ over here. That's Christian. But the Christian paradigm will look at the good God, that there's a good God in heaven that's supposed to be looking down on you and taking care of you, and if you're bad, he'll punish you. So it just depends on what branch of Christianity you're brought up in. You could be brought up in a branch of Christianity where Jesus loves me no matter what I do. Jesus will always be there protecting me. Or you can be brought up in a branch of Christianity where God rewards the people who are doing good, the good people. He will reward them with riches and health and all the good things. But the bad people, he will punish. And so... though bad, if you're being, if something is not happening the way that you want it, God is punishing you. So we have this from childhood. Like if things aren't going the way that I think they should go, then I am bad and God is punishing me in some form or another. But when you're talking about Ishwara, it's a totally different understanding of God. You know? That Ishwara is not somebody different. There's no Ishwara out there. Ishwara is the manifestation of Satchitananda. And this body, mind, sense organs is a part of you, not a part of somebody else. It's a part of you, the total.
And then how do you view pain as opposed to well-being in this, by what you just described?
Well, it depends. Like if you say that this physical body is 50% meant for 50% sukha, 50% dukkha. Every one of us, you've taken this upadhi, you might see rich people and you think, oh, they have everything they could possibly want. But actually, when you start going inside to their life, they also have a lot of fear and a lot of sorrow and a lot of worry. A lot of competition, you know, tremendous amount of competition, like who has the mostest and the bestest, you know, and who's the coolest. It goes on and on and on. There's so everybody has 50-50, pleasure and pain, situation. Situations that bring about pleasure and pain in the mind, according to the Shastra.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have your pain. You also have a physical body. You're going to have your pain, because the physical body, being a physical body, is going to grow old, have disease, and die. Okay? So pain is going to be there. There's change. As long as there's change in the universe, there's going to be pain. Just by the mere fact that there's change. Right? So sukha and dukkha, pleasure and pain, on every level is part of the universe. Right? So what they'll say is that's one reason to we try to stay on the side of Dharma, because you don't want to attract papa to yourself. In this life, you stay on the side of Dharma. You get the protection of Dharma, which we naturally do it. We naturally try to stay on the side of Dharma to get the protection of Dharma. Like, let me give you a really simple example. You know, you cross the street when the light is green. You're staying on the side of Dharma. You're staying on the side of the law, so you don't have to risk being hit. You still look at both ways, you know. But you stay on the side of Dharma, even on a subtle level. You learn also, you learn about Dharma just from your behavior. If you're unkind to someone, you will suffer. The results of an unkindness are experienced by both people. The person that you're unkind to, and yourself. If you're harsh with somebody, that person will be hurt by the harshness, but you will also be hurt by that harshness. And so we keep learning from the creation. But the creation, our Ishwara, is not our enemy. Ishwara is always there to help. You know? But to help with what? Well, to help with antakarana shuddhi, to help with our growth. Penny and Benny.
Sounds very small compared to what we were just talking about, mm-hmm. but I was wondering if you knew anything about the etymology of the Apasamara. He interests me.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
I don't know that much, except Swamiji had the big realization when he was talking about with us, as that it's the unconscious, because upa means that which has been taken away. You know? So smata is memory. So you could just say forgetfulness, but also all of our experiences that go into the unconscious
mm-hmm.
also have been, yeah, exactly.
They have what?
Have been swallowed. The experiences that are in your unconscious have been forgotten purposefully. They've been swallowed into the unconscious. And so Swamiji was talking about this in a new way. But
was that on Guru Purnima day?
No. I don't know. I don't think so. Let's see. I don't remember which day it was. I don't think I'll get what I'm looking for here, but let me just try. I don't have it. Oh, wait, I'm trying. Want of memory, confusion of mind, but I want more than that. I want the story. I think I might be able to get it on Wikipedia, but I also have another book I can look in and just get more of the story. That would be so nice, right?
It is. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
I love the
symbol. Yeah. So it's Apasmata. APASMAA. Long A. SMAA. All right.
He usually looks like he's like he has a certain vanity about him.
But his mustache.
Like this,
yeah.
You know, vanity of individuality.
Yeah.
And then he, but he's
kind of
sweetly looking at Dakshinamurti,
yeah.
Because he knows he's okay.
Yeah.
Keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got
so
a big,
sweet.
Big smile on his face.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not.
Well, sad. Because he's with Bhagwan. Bhagwan's giving him a lot of attention.
I don't put on his neck.
Oh, yeah.
It's very sweet, though.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
image now, I never really had the image like I do now until Swamiji really talked about it. Now when I visualize Dakshinamurti, I see the little Upasmara
yeah.
down there.
Yeah.
I took that little portion at the foot and him under and blew it up.
Yeah.
And goes,
oh, that's so nice. That's sweet. Yeah. Yeah, that's perfect.
I have a question about, I was glad you mentioned this, this is something I've been thinking about a lot lately, is when somebody is having difficulty with someone, or they're even just, I think, as small as someone annoying you,
yeah.
trying to sort of be open to them. And sometimes I'll like, even just think, recalling the word compassion or something like that to kind of remind
yeah.
myself that like we're all sort of part of the same thing. But my problem or my confusion with that is I think that I like confuse that quality with not having boundaries with other people.
You could get confused that where, in fact, you should maybe think of it like this, that it really has nothing to do with boundaries. That's a different issue. That's objective. That's an objective issue. It has to do with yourself not taking them inside and allowing them to be. So when you say something like, it's fine, you can be with me, means that you have it's fine for you to be here. But in me, nothing closes up in your presence. That's what I mean by welcoming. Because what happens is, for some reason you get a problem with somebody, and then you close up and there's a natural pushing away or rejection or all kinds of tussle that goes around because of the thought of that person or the presence of that person or even fear of the presence of that person, you know, like they may come, something like that. So if you work on your relationship with that person so that you can allow them to be. If you say, okay, you can be with me, it's fine. It's like saying, you have a right to be. You can be here. And if I say, you can be with me, another way of saying the same thing is, I can keep you outside, and you have as much right to be as I have a right to be. It is fine. And so, I would say something like this. If that problem comes up, I would say, it's okay, you can be with me. So you might have a little statement that for you allows that person a right to exist, and that you are fine to be, that you can be with that person as they are. That they don't have to change for you to be full and complete. That's another way of saying it. You can be as you are. I don't need you to change. Another way of saying the same thing is, you know, I can be with you as you are. I don't need you to be in a particular way in order for me to be whole and complete. So that's another language.
Well, that's freedom.
It's a great freedom for the one who can say that. That to me shortens down into, it's okay, you can be with me.
But even if, just a very, very small example, but somebody's really annoying you and sitting next to you on the bus.
Uh-huh.
And you could think that about them and still, like, move.
Yeah, exactly.
But have that feeling towards them.
Yeah, you can accept them.
Yeah.
But also, they might be infringing on your
right.
physical privacy.
Get off the bus.
And so you can leave. But that is objective. I mean, you can do something that is objective without inner turmoil or hatred.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't... You don't have to have hatred for that person or be suffering inside and at the same time decide to get up and move.
Yeah.
See what I mean? That's an important distinction to be able to make, because otherwise you can think, you know, if I'm going to be nice to that person, if I'm going to accept that person, then I'm going to have to do this, this, and this. That isn't true at all. It's just that the way you are with that person isn't going to have inner hatred. It'll be just objective. Like, say you think, oh, if I'm nice to that person, then they want to go out to lunch all the time. That's not true. You can be totally nice to that person and just say, no, I don't like to go out to lunch. No, thanks. I don't want to. I'm not good at that. But you can say that with no ill will, you know?
Can it also happen that you might, in order to get to the place where you can have no hatred and ill will, you might actually need to get up and move to a different city?
Yeah, you might need to.
Just because being so close is annoying to the point where you
have
dhamma.
That's right. You have to take it in stages. That's why this, you can be with me, the some parts of your mind might go, oh, I'm sorry. That is not true. That's it. Then you have to go to the little one inside. The important thing is that you want to work on it because it's your freedom. You know, if we just kind of take it on a surface external level, then we're not getting the freedom which we can easily have. You know?
Well, that's what you were seeking when you gave a hello to that person.
I was seeking the freedom.
Yeah, not friendship.
Not friendship. I wasn't seeking friendship. I was seeking, let me be free in the presence of this person. Let me be free in the thought of this person. You know? And of course, that person is very benefited by it also, because I'm sure that person feels your hostility. It's not just you. It's a there's a hostility there, and both sides are going to be hurt by it. But the big thing to realize is how much you are hurt by it. You know, and so it's, and at some point along the way, and I think there's different levels of this, just speaking from my own experience, there's different levels along the way of really having any type of rancor toward other beings is not worth it for you personally. You don't like the way this person is, and you're upset about it, or this and that, it's not worth it for you personally. And when that is true, then there's a value for you to do something about it. Because otherwise there's more of a value of getting back at that person or doing something or acting it out in some way. There comes a time when you may do things like move or something like that, but what is the most value is the shanti inside.
And then there's sometimes when your dharma is to actually, like with Arjuna, to kill people. Or in my job, I have to do things.
Yeah, that's right. That's the dharma of the job.
Yeah.
But that's also objective. It would be different. Like, say living with Arjuna, with you as a lawyer. What you're really about is getting totally juiced on the slaughter.
Craving.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be problematic. Whereas doing the objective action as a lawyer, you representing these people, you do everything you can to win within the law. Within the law.
Yeah.
So that's the job. And say if you're a soldier, you know, then you're doing everything within the law of war to win, and even if it means destroying the other person. But what if your whole thing is destroying the other person? Then that's a dharma, that's a rakshasa, that's an asura. And we all have all three in us. It's not that somebody's just walking around, unless they're a devata, walking around, they're only sattva. These rakshasa and asuric tendencies are there. That's why Krishna goes through so much trouble to point them all out. And the things that he's pointing out, you can see all of them today. It's kind of interesting to know all of these things that are there today were there thousands of years ago. You know, it's not just today. And it's not just thousands of years ago. It's kind of the nature of the beast, of sattva, rajas, and tamas. And so the thing is to have that commitment to let the rajas and tamas become the apasmara, you know? Let those things be held in check, the ones that are adharmic. Yeah. Tamas also allows you to sleep at night. You know, rajas also gives you energy. So we're looking at we're looking at those sides that are, when we're talking about values in the mind. Yeah. we're not looking at them positively, we're looking at the negative aspects of rajas and tamas, the rajasic mind, the tamasic mind, like that. See what I mean? Let's call it a night.